For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Let's begin. And on behalf of my parents, who are here, thank God for a good and happy reason, their annual visit, which this year also became a visit for our daughter's wedding. And on my own behalf, we very much appreciate your allowing us to dedicate this particular session of the Essentials class in memory of my brother, their son, Amram Hillel, Zichrono Livracha. The yard site of my brother is observed in Adar, which comes out sometime in February or March. But because my parents are here now, and because traveling the Atlantic Ocean is not a simple matter, we thought we would take advantage of the opportunity when we're together to study Torah in his memory. And we appreciate those of you who adjusted your schedule. Everybody adjusted their schedules, we know, to be here early tonight because the class normally starts at 8 o'clock. Now we're starting a late 7:30, so we appreciate very much that you're doing that. And we know that there are all kinds of butterfly consequences. You know, when a butterfly flaps its wings, there are all kinds of consequences that will emanate throughout human history because we changed our schedule tonight, and we appreciate that. Tonight's topic is Limud HaTorah, Torah study. And the way we have the evening planned, we will spend the first hour or so, my father and I, presenting different aspects of the topic. It's impossible to comprehensively cover this topic like every topic that you have in the Essentials class. That's what makes them so essential. And we'll do the best we can to at least touch on some critical aspects of Limud HaTorah. Then we'll take a break after about an hour or so, and people will have a chance to refresh themselves. We'll move over to more informal setting on the other side of the hall, where we'll have what has become really an annual treat as well, which is our opportunity to chat with you, to hear from you, and to interact on various topics of your choice. And we look forward to that as well. That will begin. We'll have about a 10 or 15 minute break, and then we'll convene again. So, in the topic of Limud HaTorah, study of Torah, the word in Hebrew, by the way, that I'm using, Talmud Torah. Talmud, the root of the word Talmud, is lamod, to learn. Limud HaTorah is the study of Torah, and in English we call it Torah study. Very comprehensive, profound, and basic concept in Judaism. It's kind of like the air we breathe. You can't do without it, and you don't appreciate it moment by moment. And yet, when you examine it closely, you find aspects of it that you never really thought of before. And that's what we're going to try to do tonight, is really just to bring a microscope onto different aspects of Talmud Torah and familiarize ourselves with why it is such an absolutely basic and critical dimension of Jewish existence. So we're going to look at a couple of things. Everybody has their outline, and we're going to go through, we'll try to keep you focused on in order so that you won't get confused, but we may jump around a little bit, and I'll try to point that out based on the page numbers as we go through. So first of all, we really want to understand that the study of Torah makes us partners with the Creator Himself. Now that on the surface sounds like a relatively straightforward sentence, but as we examine this, I think you'll see that this is really an astounding assertion, and it's really a very empowering and inspiring concept that a Jew is given the opportunity, actually required, to partner with the Almighty in the creation of the universe itself. Where does this come from? Where does this concept come from? So first of all, in your outline, take a look at the first selection that we've included here, lifted from the Zohar, in Parshas Truma, somewhere in the book of Exodus, where the Zohar asserts, and this is, we're taking him out of context, meaning that he's developing a very, very profound thought, but the famous Zohar, which is quoted all the time, and perhaps so often that we fail to realize all of the significance of what he's saying. It says the Zohar in Aramaic, Kad bara kud shabrichu alma, when the Almighty created the universe, Havi istaka baba araisa, he would look in the Torah, uvara alma, and create the world. Uva araisa isbiri alma, and through the Torah, the world was created. So this is istakel ba'araisa uvara alma. This is the Aramaic. He looked, he gazed at the Torah, and it created the world, which means the Torah is the blueprint of the world itself. Now there are many important implications to this assertion of the Zohar, and it's actually, this Zohar is mirrored to some degree in the pasuk that we have at the very beginning of the Torah, Bereshis bara Elokim. Bereshis.
Thank you.
Bereshis bara Elokim. Is this any better? Changing anything? Bereshis bara Elokim. In which we translate it, in the beginning God created. In the beginning God created, or in the beginning of creation God, etc. But the Medrash tells us that Bereshis bara Elokim, for the sake of the Torah, did God create the world. Reshis is one code word that the Medrash goes through great pains to develop as a word representing the concept of the Torah. Reshis, primary. The Torah is considered primary. And God created the world, Bereshis, for the sake of the Torah. For the sake of other things as well that are called Reshis. So, this really turns the whole paradigm of the meaning of the Torah and its relationship to existence on its head. Because we tend to think of existence as there's reality, there's life, there's you, there's me, there's the world, there's the universe, and then there's God inserting into the universe something extremely meaningful called His blueprint for life, His message for life, how He wants us to live our lives. That's exactly not what the Torah is. The Torah is actually pre-exists the world. It isn't created. The Torah doesn't exist in order for the world to have meaning. The world exists in order for the Torah to be realized. It's an amazing thing if you think about it. We are here so that the Torah can be expressed. That also doesn't make any sense, because if we're not here, who cares if the Torah is expressed? Well, the answer is God. But if you ever tried to get into the divine will that caused God to bring the world into creation, you will never stop and you will never understand it. We understand that the Almighty creates the world in order for the Torah to be physically realized. So the world is here so that the Torah can have a platform, a stage. So He looks at the Torah and creates the world. So implication number one is that the world is here for the Torah. It's not that the world has meaning through the Torah. It doesn't exist independently of the Torah. The Torah causes the world to exist. Second point here is that, or I should say even the third point, because really we said two things here, that God, that the world is here for the Torah, and the Torah is the cause of the existence of the world. The third point is that we are therefore, those of us who are obligated in performing the Torah and in knowing the Torah, in bringing the Torah into the world, we have now become partners with the Almighty in creation of the world. Because the world itself is called into being by the existence of the Torah, and therefore, as we bring the Torah into the world ourselves, through our engagement with it, through the study of it, through the comprehension of it, the world itself, it continues to be called into being by that Torah. We're bringing more Torah, more being, more reason for the world to come into existence because of the fact that we're bringing the Torah into the world. So God, in a certain sense, sets the world up in such a way that it won't exist until human beings partner with Him to continue to make the world exist. It's an amazing concept. It's an amazing concept that God decides, so to speak, He chooses to set up a world in which human beings now are His partners in causing the world to exist. It also means, theoretically, that we could unilaterally cause the world not to exist. And as we'll see in a couple minutes, that actually might have happened. depending on choices that human beings make. Here is a very practical application of the concept that we just articulated. You have an 8-year-old boy, and he's going to cheder. And on the way to cheder that day, there's a big deal going on in the house, because his parents realize that this is the first day that he's going to study Mishnah. And it's been announced in an email to the parents that they're going to start Mishnah that day, and they're going to start with the 5th chapter of Tractate Bava Kamma. Tractate Bava Kamma deals with civil damages. 5th chapter is called Shor Shanagach Arba V'Chamisha. An ox that gored 4 or 5 times. Okay. So there's this great excitement in the home. The mother and the father send this child off with great fanfare. They take a picture at the door. They're proud of him. Their religious values of the house are about to be passed on to the next generation. And he's going to sit down and spend an hour or two learning what the law is if an ox, which he never saw in his life, because he lives in Manhattan, and he has never seen anything alive other than human beings, right? Maybe he saw a bird once living on the 30th floor of some skyscraper. And he's going to study what happens if an ox gores another ox, and how many times, and how much does he have to pay. And then when he comes home, he's going to tell his parents about this, and they're going to have some kind of a spiritually elevated experience, because their son now knows the first line of Shor Shanagach Arba V'Chamisha Pam. Now why? What in the world is going on here? The answer is that he's not studying the Torah so that he will know what to do at his bar mitzvah. He's not studying the Torah so that he will be able to properly honor his parents. He's studying the Torah because the world needs the Torah brought into it. Or put another way, an ox goring another ox, and how the Torah says we should compensate the owner of the victim ox, all of that is nothing other than a this-worldly expression of a truth that existed before there was a world, before there was an ox, before there were owners, before there was goring. God created a world with an ox, with an owner, with goring, so that the truth that pre-exists the world could be realized by the ox goring another ox, and Jews knowing what God says about how that should be and what should happen as a result. And so this child is now about to undertake a spiritually meaningful endeavor by studying the will of God, and he's bringing into the world by studying it the will of God. And the world now has more emanations of the truth of God's will than it had before he studied it. And so he's now fulfilled a religious obligation. All of that really flows from the idea that the world itself is created from the Torah, which means that the world itself reflects the truth of the Torah, which pre-exists the world itself. Now, I can see on some of your faces that this is actually like a bewildering concept. That's because we are all very much attached to the notion that we have an existence that's independent of the Torah, and then we choose to give it meaning by following the Torah. And that's precisely not how the Jewish people understands its relationship to Torah. We actually understand that we're here to give the Torah life in the world that God created. That the Torah pre-exists our lives, and our lives are here in order for the Torah to be played out. Let's move on and see how this works a little bit more practically. In the second selection I have here on page 1, we've quoted a Rashi's commentary on the 6th day of creation. Every day of creation, it says, Vayhi erev, vayhi boker, yom echad. Vayhi erev, vayhi boker, it was evening, it was morning, yom sheni, yom shlishi, yom revi'i. So it says, day 3, third day, day 4, or fourth day. When it gets to the 6th day, it says, Vayhi erev, vayhi boker, yom hashishi. It should say yom shishi, just like it's day 6, or 6th day. Why does it say yom hashishi? So that extra hey, which happens to have the numerical value of 5, that extra hey is perplexing. So Rashi comments and gives us two interpretations of this whole unusual phrasing of day 6. So we'll read the English. The sixth day, the letter hey, which I've said is value of 5, is added to 6 at the completion of Bereshis, of Genesis, meaning the completion of the 6 days of creation, to indicate that it was conditional upon Israel accepting the 5 books of the Torah. So hey, Yom HaShishi, meaning that the 6th day and creation itself depends on hey, it depends on 5, it depends on the 5 books of the Torah. The 5 books of the Torah have to be there, and that will make the world have existence. If the world doesn't exist, if the 5 books of the Torah aren't there, aren't accepted by the Jewish people, then the world itself is not only not completed, it doesn't exist at all. That's one interpretation, says Rashi. Going on, a second interpretation, and I've translated as literally as I can, all is dependent until the 6th day, meaning the 6th of Sivan, which was destined for the giving of the Torah. So the second interpretation is Yom HaShishi, that all-important day 6 of the month of Sivan, when the Torah is given at Sinai, all of that, you know, all of creation is dependent on day 6. So here too, we have the concept that the world itself only comes into being given that it's going to be a place where the Torah itself is going to be played out. Look at the selection from Rav Chaim Volozhin. Rav Chaim Volozhin is very interesting. Personally, I spent 2 summers ago, we actually were at his kever, at his grave, in where? Volozhin. That's why he's called Rav Chaim Volozhin. And Rav Chaim Volozhin is a disciple of the Gaon of Vilna, and he wrote a sefer, one of many, called the Nefesh HaChaim. The Nefesh HaChaim is very much about the spiritual mechanisms of the world, how prayer works, how a human being uttering words actually affect the upper world. He describes the whole hierarchy, a mystical hierarchy that exists between this lower world and the upper world. And in the Nefesh HaChaim, he takes this concept of Istakel Ba'oraisa, that God looked at the world, at the Torah, and created the world. Let's join him in progress, where he says that since the Torah is the blueprint and origin of the world, continued involvement in Torah is necessary to keep the world going. Says the Nefesh HaChaim, Rav Chaim Volozhin. Therefore, the primary source of life, light, and existence of all the world is the involvement of the Jewish people in Torah study. This is a major thesis that Rav Chaim develops, in which he actually suggests, moving on, let's look at the selection of the bottom of the page. For this reason, the sages teach that one who studies Torah without ulterior motives, which means lishma, Torah for its own sake, which means he's studying Torah not so that he could be known as a knowledgeable person, not so he could be recognized, not so he'll be able to satisfy people when they ask him a question, he'll be able to say, I know the answer. He studies Torah because he wants to actually be involved in the study of Torah, as the Nefesh HaChaim says, simply because he wants to be involved in studying it. So the sages say such a person is considered a companion. The meaning is that he's a companion, a colleague of God, so to speak, by facilitating the continuation of the world through his Torah study. Just as God created and maintains the world through Torah, so too does the individual who studies Torah. And moving on, the Gemara in Tractate Brachos 6a asserts the following. From where do we know, and this is something that we're familiar with, from the ethics of our fathers as well. From where do we know that the Shekhinah is with us even when one person is with even one person who sits and studies Torah? Because the verse states, wherever I permit my name to be mentioned, I shall come to you and bless you. That passage is not from Peter, Paul, and Mary. That passage is actually from the book of Exodus. Wherever I will cause my name to be mentioned. So therefore, the idea is that the Shekhinah actually dwells in the world because of the study of Torah. The Shekhinah itself dwells in the world because of the study of Torah, which means the presence of God. So it's not just that the world is created from the Torah, but that God continues to pervade and permeate existence through the study of Torah. tremendous amount of responsibility put on a human being. And that leads us to the next thing that comes from the Nefesh HaChaim, where he says, any place which the Torah enlightens with its light and holiness even once will be eternally and constantly holy. In other words, wherever the Torah came into the world, that place becomes sanctified, because the Torah itself brings holiness into the world. I'm reminded of this trip that I just mentioned a couple of summers ago. I shared with many of you in different contexts, but there was one point in the trip where we went to to a small village outside of Kovno known as Slobodka. Slobodka was you may recall from previous series, Slobodka was really a capital, so to speak, of Torah study, a tiny little village across the river from Kovno, but it was really a center from which emanated many, many Torah scholars who end up, after the war actually, taking the refugee Jewish people to new heights by building everything from Ner Israel and the Lakewood Yeshiva and the Nir Yeshiva and Torah Vadas, all the yeshivas that really became the footstools upon which the Torah world rested after the war came from Slobodka. So we went to Slobodka to see where this all started. So it was an amazing thing. We have a busload of intelligent people, and we're sitting there looking at an empty lot. There's nothing there. Where the yeshiva used to exist, there is nothing there at all. And we're sitting there pacing it off, and we're asking the guide, where was it exactly? He said, well, it started over there. And we're saying, and where was the Holy Ark? Where was the Aron Kodesh? Oh, it was over here. How far down into the lot did it go? And there's nothing there. But as I said to somebody later on, this was a portal. This was a place in the physical universe through which all kinds of emanations from the Almighty came in, and from there to people's hearts, and from their hearts and minds to thousands and thousands of students, and really to the world itself. So where the Torah exists, holiness itself exists, and therefore it was actually important to us to imagine and see the physical place, even though there was nothing there to see. Looking at this selection from Paul Johnson, wonderful guy, not an expert on Torah, but he certainly is an unbelievable historian, and in his history of the Jews, it's worth reading the introduction to that book, by the way, why he wrote that book, because he never planned to write a history of the Jews. But Paul Johnson writes, quote, certainly the world without the Jews would have been a radically different place. Humanity might have eventually stumbled upon all the Jewish insights, but we cannot be sure. All the great conceptual discoveries of the human intellect seem obvious and inescapable once they've been revealed, but it requires a special genius to formulate them for the first time. The Jews had this gift. To them we owe the idea of, we see here, equality before the law, both divine and human, the sanctity of life and the dignity of a human person, the individual conscience, and so a personal redemption, collective conscience, and so social responsibility, peace as an abstract ideal, and love as the foundation of justice. And before we go into those, we'll see examples of these in a minute, Paul Johnson is entirely wrong. The Jews did not have this gift, and he does not owe thanks to their special genius. The Jews really are not any wiser than anybody else. God gave the Jews the Torah, and the Torah itself is the source of the wisdom that the world now has access to these things. As Moshe says to the Jewish people in the book of Deuteronomy, Ki mi goy gadol shelo lakim krovim alav. What great nation has a God so close to him, Kashem Elokeinu, like the Lord our God? Umi goy gadol shelo chukimu mishpatim tzadikim. What great nation has such righteous and just laws and statutes like the Jewish people? This is exactly what the Torah predicts, that Paul Johnson would say this. It is your source of wisdom and your deep insight to the eyes of the nations. They'll look at the Jewish people and say, Rak am chacham benavon hagoy hagadol hazeh. Only a wise and penetrating and deeply understanding nation could this Jewish people be. That's what they'll say when they see you following the ways of the Torah. And so the Torah actually brings God's personality into the world. The point is, it's not just wisdom. It's actually the attitude that God has about the world that He created is reflected in the Torah itself. And so, as we go through, looking at page 2, towards the middle of the page, right after Paul Johnson's list here of the gifts of the Jewish people to the world, look at this selection from Vayikra. As an example, we can all probably pull examples out of the Torah. The Torah says, Lo sa'asu avu b'mishpat. That's the whole idea of equality before the law. Lo sa'hadar p'nei gadol. Don't favor a great man or a wealthy man. Betzedek tishpod amisecha. With fairness shall you judge your fellow man. These are concepts that we consider to be basic. Where do they come from, though? They come from the revolutionary insertion of the Torah into the world. And this is how the world itself gets its concept of justice. We have to realize, if you study human history, you realize that the history of ideas, it was a revolution. The idea that somebody with wealth and somebody without wealth was equal before the law. That was a new idea. Because wealth meant that God favored you. And therefore, you are right because you're wealthy. And if you were right, then you'd be wealthy. The Torah says, no, wealth has nothing to do with it. There's justice. There's right and there's wrong, and there's justice. Moving on. The sanctity of life. So the Torah introduces in one of the seven Noahide laws, Shafech dam ha'adam ba'adam dam ha'yishafech. One who spills the blood of a man, by man shall his own blood be spilled. Moving on. In Devarim, Deuteronomy, Lo sa'ametzes levavcha, the whole concept of tzedakah, don't close your heart. Don't close your hand. Don't harden your heart. Don't close your hand from your indigent brother. And the Rambam is one of many, many different sources that we could point to for the value of peace. Gadol hashalom shekol haTorah nitna la'asher shalom alam. The greatest peace, the entire Torah was given to bring about peace. What Maimonides means there, of course, is not just that it was given to help negotiate armistice agreements between warring factions. Obviously, what he means is that the Torah was given to represent the holistic view of the whole purpose of existence itself, the harmony of existence itself. That's the point of the Torah, and that's the ultimate piece. Looking at Smith, he's about 90 years old. The Religions of Man, he's an expert in comparative religions. So look at this quote here. It is here that we come to the supreme achievement of Jewish thought, not in its monotheism as such, but in the character described to the God it discovered to be one. And then he goes on and shows how the other polytheists attributed all kinds of lowly human attitudes to their gods, where the Jewish God, so to speak, God is a God of righteousness. I'm looking at the end of this quote. Whose loving kindness is from everlasting to everlasting, and whose tender mercies are over all his creations. V'rachamav al kol ma'aseh. It's quoted from the Ashrei that we recite three times a day. Smith is asserting that we alone have introduced to the world the concept of a God who has his own personality and whom we try to emulate. How do we do that? Through the study of Torah. I'm going to move on quickly. That's one thing. So one thing that's accomplished when we study Torah is that we become partners with God in the creation of the world, in bringing holiness into the world, and in bringing God's attitudes into the world. On page 4, you'll see some selections that refer to the concept of God, of the study of Torah as the continuation of revelation. The Sinai experience continues all the time. This is reflected, by the way, in the blessings that we recite when we study Torah. Every day in the morning, a person is obligated to recite a blessing because we're going to be studying Torah all day, right? And so a person says, among other things, Baruch Atah Hashem, no sein ha-Torah. Blessed are you, God, not who gave the Torah, but who gives the Torah. So we view the study of Torah as an ongoing process of revelation. Why? So let's say this very quickly. Because we understand that the Torah is literally of God's mind. And we don't believe that it's possible for a human being to be able to absorb God's mind naturally. We believe it's possible for us to say the words of the Torah. It's possible for us to say, you shall do this. But to absorb it and have it permeate our being and have it transform us, That's not possible without God continuously inserting His Torah into our minds and hearts and into our soul. It's a miraculous process that requires the same miracle that happened at Sinai has to happen every time a Jew opens up his mouth. And so, look at the third selection on page 4, the Gemara in Brachos 21b. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says, "One who teaches his son Torah is considered to have received the Torah from Sinai." We see this from the previous verses. Teach them to your children, your children's children. Immediately after it says, the day you stood before God in Sinai. Meaning the connection of these concepts teaches that what teaching one's child and standing on Mount Sinai teaches that they're connected. So, and then one more selection from the Chaim Volozhin. Every word of Torah ever uttered, on the bottom of page 4, every word of Torah ever uttered was foretold in the Torah God gave to Moshe at Sinai. This is part of what Rav Chaim Volozhin is asserting, that every time one opens one's mouth and reveals another aspect or even inkling of the truth, then he's actually revealing Torah that was already given once to the world and now making it possible for that Torah to be revealed again. So it's an ongoing process of revelation. And finally, the notion that all wisdom in the world is contained in the Torah really shouldn't be that startling. If the world itself is created out of the Torah, can there be any wisdom about the world that wouldn't be sourced in the Torah? So what would be our limitation in knowing all the wisdom that there is to know in the world? The limitation that we would have would simply be our ability to comprehend the Torah. The more immersed we were in the Torah, the more skilled we were in deciphering the various codes and levels of the Torah, the more we were able to assimilate the various connections to the different pieces of the Torah, the more we would be able to see all wisdom in the world. Physics, science, geometry, reality, whatever it is, would all be reflected in the Torah. And it's simply a question of our ability to see the below the surface level. And that's why the selection we have on page 3, Hafoch ba dekulo ba, delve into the Torah and continue to delve into it, for everything is in it. What the Torah doesn't do, however, is reveal its secrets immediately. The Torah requires a person to be immersed totally in it in order to be able to begin to uncover its secrets. Another thing that's accomplished through the study of Torah is actually that we continue revelation at Har Sinai. Finally, I'll try to put number 3 and number 4 together for the purpose of time. By studying the Torah, we actually know what God wants. Period. Very simple. You can't know what God wants unless you study it. But what do we mean by know what God wants? You can actually robotically know what to do. You can actually know to affix a mezuzah on a doorpost. And then you can know exactly how to do it. Take a nail and take a hammer and put it on. Or you can know the intention that the Almighty has, or some of the intention that He has, as you affix the mezuzah on the doorpost. And so, taking a look at this quote from the Gaon of Vilna, on page 6, the top of the page, on page 6, the translation doesn't do full justice to it. Without wisdom, it's not good for the soul. That's the passage in Proverbs. This means that if a person just performs mitzvah without accompanying it with Torah study, it will not be good for his soul. This is called doing mitzvah without wisdom. It is not good for the soul. His soul will not have pleasure from doing the mitzvah since he doesn't know their rationale and thus does them without enthusiasm. Now, that on the surface makes a lot of sense. The Vilna Gaon is saying much more than simply that a person relates to it much if he understands it. The Vilna Gaon is talking about the effect. When he talks about the soul having pleasure, he's talking about the effect on the neshama of a human being by performing a mitzvah, which he relates to because he's actually studied the rationale and the intent of the divine creator and author of the Torah, then his soul itself is actually affected by it. So the point here is that there's a form of transformation that occurs when a person immerses him or herself into the study of Torah. Looking at a very famous passage in we're looking at page 6, the second selection. The Torah says, "V'yahavtos Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha v'chol nafshecha v'chol mi'adecha." You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your ability. Next passage. And these words that I teach you today shall be upon your heart. Says Rashi on that passage, looking at the third selection there, Rashi commenting on that passage, what does it mean, love God? Let these words that I teach you today be upon your heart. That the Torah is answering the question, I just told you to love God, how do you do that? Let these words be upon your heart. For through doing so, studying Torah, you will come to know God and follow His ways. So the study of Torah is actually an act of love. It's actually an act of relationship. It's actually an act of communion. It's actually an act of being involved in a dialogue with the Almighty Himself. So Torah is actually very much related to the concept of prayer. Even though it seems like it's the absorption of information, Torah is actually the human being submitting himself to being in a give and take with the creator of the universe himself. And so that a person actually is elevated and transformed by the process of being connected to the Almighty. And this, I'll close with this. There's so much more to say. Maybe we'll get to it during the question and answer. I warned my father if I go first, I'm going to encroach his time, into his time. And I'm being extremely careful, and I've done it anyway. The question that's posed is, why would somebody who spends 15 or 18 hours a day studying the minutiae of Torah law, sometimes the most arcane laws, some of which don't seem to have any application nowadays whatsoever, right? Why would that person experience personal transformation? Why would that person become closer to God? So A, we've said, because he's a partner with God in bringing God's wisdom into the world. B, he's learning how to think like God. But C, the point is that he's actually submitting himself to the will of God. The act of submission, the act of humbling oneself before a higher wisdom actually transforms a person in terms of his or her personal characteristics. Because the study of Torah, by definition, requires not sitting back in a lounge chair, kicking one's feet up, relaxing with a nice, delicious book, you know, the secrets of the universe by God, you know, next to the fire. It requires tremendous sacrifice. It requires diligence. It requires discipline. It requires perseverance. It requires going back to sections that don't make sense. It requires working hard. It requires traveling somewhere to go to a master who knows this, who's an expert in this area. It requires memorization. It requires honing one's skills. There's so much that goes into it. The act of submitting oneself to become a master of this material, which is divine in origin, itself is a transforming process. And that's why, traditionally, those who have immersed themselves in the study of Torah and the mastery of Torah also happen to be, most often, the spiritual leaders of the Jewish people, even in matters not intellectual, because they've just spent their lives actually humbling themselves in order to be able to know the will of God. And in so doing, they've sublimated their own egos, they've given up on their own convenience, they've made their lives not be about what they want or even about the conclusions that they want to get to. They've actually surrendered their entire being to the will of God. And in the process, they've transformed themselves because their lives are no longer about themselves. They're about bringing down the will of God from heaven. So this is really some of what's involved in the study of Torah. And now I'm going to turn things over to my father, who will be picking up on a couple of more very important sections of this topic. And we'll have a chance afterwards during the Q&A. If you want to follow up on this, please, we encourage you to do so.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.